We're going to begin with our candle lighting and our centering, and some of our participants are going to light the candles this morning. Bibi and Judy are going to help light the candles. I guess I have to do this. Here you go. And so now I would like for us all to read together the call to worship. You have it on your programs. It's from Martin Luther King Jr., whose day and whose weekend and whose birthday we celebrate this weekend. Okay, everybody ready? We shall hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. And now I would like to light the chalice as we say together our affirmation. We have a responsive reading this morning, which is also by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and it's number 584 in the book. A Network of Mutuality. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny.
Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice
everywhere. There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation.
The foundation of such a method is love.
Before it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds which precipitate and perpetuate war. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means.
We shall hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope.
Thank you. And now we're going to have an opening hymn, and the hymn is number in your books, is number 199, Precious Lord, Take My Hand, number 199.
Wonderful, soulful version of this. We're going to do the UU version, which is a tad more staid. We invite you to stand as you are willing or able.
I am weak, I am
part, but very meaningful. And now is the time when our service, when we share our joys and concerns, and to do that, we've traditionally been lining up on each side of the room, and then coming forward to light a candle or put a stone in the water. So if anyone has joys and concerns they'd like to share, please come forward.
I'm Lauren. A friend of mine, Lucille Avakian, her father had a brain aneurysm about a year ago, and he's going for his third surgery this week. So she's lighting a candle for her and her family.
I'm Mark, and this break in school, I've been victim of a lot of medical intervention, one of which was my own surgery for carpal tunnel syndrome Tuesday, so I was advised not to high-five for like a week, so we'll see how it goes. I have burn supper coming up, so this hand is going to play the bagpipes, so it has to be remote-controlled. The day after, Wednesday, I thought, oh, I'm doing well, let me go out and do some things I have to get done. And I was halfway down county when I got a call from my sister-in-law telling me that my mother was in the hospital up in Northern Dutchess. Mm-hmm. And she woke up experiencing quite a lot of very, very unusual bleeding and ended up in the hospital. And since my stepfather had died of liver cancer, everybody's tension level rocketed way up. It ended up being nothing. She was home. My brother and I have been taking turns spending the day with her. But for a lady who at 75 has no sign of slowing down whatsoever, this gave her a little step to just kind of take a pause, and she's looking forward to getting just back on it. But this is for my mom, for Gail.
Hi, I'm Pete.
I'm Lee.
And we'd like to light a candle for our daughter, Tali, who turns 15 tomorrow.
Do we stand here or? I think I'll stand here. Hi, I'm Alona, and I have a joy and a concern. And my joy is that I got in the mail this week from Bob a tag that said Alona. And I had announced that, I guess the previous week, the week that I was here, that I was going to start just amongst friends and family using my Hebrew name that I got when I gave myself when I was bat mitzvahed in 2006, the name Alona, which means oak tree, and that I was going to start using it, and that I sort of got that from a dream that I'd had the night before I came here. So it was just really nice that Bob, who is always amazingly considerate, and as Judy is also, I'm just sort of amazed at people's thoughtfulness, generosity here, and love. So that is my joy. And my concern is that Ralph's mom is now in hospice. And she was, I think, put in the hospital last week. And she's out of the hospital, and she's comfortable now. She has wonderful aides. But it's, what I really understood about hospice is that if she gets symptoms where she would need to be hospitalized or where you would think she would be, what they do is respond to you with comfort measures. and that she has these two amazing aides, and she has Alzheimer's, and she's, you know, usually at mealtime it's the aides kind of giving her the food rather than she's saying that she's hungry, you know. And so now what they have told her at hospice is when she's hungry, then you feed her. If she wants to get up out of the bed, and she now has a hospital bed, you can put her in the chair or not, but that they're really, you know, it's really a big change in how they are responding to her, which I think is appropriate, but it's sort of a big concern, you know, a big shift. And Ralph is doing okay, and one sister's there now, and another sister's coming tomorrow, and Ralph wants to be around for phone calls, and he also has the end of a cold, so he's not feeling great. But anyway, I thought I would light a candle for her. So thank you.
I'm Judy, and my husband Bob and I celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary last night with a and they said it couldn't be done with a very lovely dinner at Zeph's in Peekskill. We have a very dear friend whose parents lived, his mother was 100, his father was 89, and they said to her, Mrs. Spitzer, you've been married so long. Did you ever consider divorce? She said, divorce never, murder often.
Are there any other joys? Any other joys or concerns that someone might like to share? Okay, at this time then I would like to light a candle for all of those joys and concerns that are in our hearts that we might not have mentioned. I think that was not a head that hit. I think it was a little car, so. And now is the time in our service when we pass the baskets and have our offering, and we're going to have some wonderful music from Pam and from Jim this morning to accompany that passing of the basket.
Seems the good that I know. gone. Didn't you love the things they stood for? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? And we'll be free. One day it's gonna be one day. Anybody here see my old friend Bobby? Can you tell me where he's gone? For some walking around over the hill, Abraham, Martin, and John.
Very moving for all of us who were here when those awful things happened so many years ago, and it's taken many, many years for healing to take place, and the tremendous loss of those people, and especially today we're thinking of Martin Luther King. So beautiful. Thank you. At this point, we're going to sing our children up to their classes, and I don't know if, yeah, we have it right, I believe it's in the service, it's Go Now in Peace, so, Go Now in Peace, Go Now in Peace, May the Spirit of Love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may. Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the Spirit of Love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. Well, this morning we are going to leap into a very, very, very vast subject, and that is Shakespeare. And I was at the Mayapack Library yesterday, and they have actually a whole bookshelf, seven rows of books about Shakespeare. There's a lot out there, and it's a big subject. But the way we're going to focus on it today is that four of us are going to share our personal responses to something in Shakespeare that has moved us or has given us some inspiration for living or has given some insight into living. I'd like to just begin a little with speaking a little bit about the Fourth UU as a shared ministry. The worship ministry helps to organize the lay-led services in coordination with our minister, Reverend Karen Brammer. And the service proposals are made and selected by the congregation. And then they're scheduled and they're conducted on the Sundays when Reverend Karen's not here. So the intent and the hope of these services is that we speak about and share what feeds our souls, those who are presenting. And we do that so that those who are coming and participating will also be fed. The service this morning focuses on a writer who has been feeding my soul for many years, the English playwright William Shakespeare, born in 1564 and died in 1616. This 400th anniversary of his death will be marked with many special events in the land of his birth and also around the world. Shakespeare is the one author whose works have been translated into every major language in the world. His plays are performed more than that of any other playwright, living or dead. His work consists of 38 plays, 154 sonnets, two long narrative poems, and a few other verses. So, there are four of us participating this morning, and the question that Judy, Bibi, and Emma, whom we're going to call in when we get to that part, we're going to go in that order. We're going to be addressing this morning, how has Shakespeare impacted our lives? What does his work tell us about what it means to be human? What do his plays, his characters teach us about living in this world? Are we richer in our understanding of people and life as a result of seeing and reading his plays? When I was in college, I tried out for the part of Portia in the play Julius Caesar. After this very nervous, nerve-wracking audition that I took, the director said to me, "Miss Manchester, you are too much in love with the words of the bard." So I did not get that part. And in fact, I joined the motley crowd murmuring around and making noise as all of the activities were going on. I became one of the crowd. But I didn't get the part, but it didn't stop me from being in love with the words of the bard. And I still am. So I'd like to just begin with something that I read in an essay by Clive James. It's an essay called Hamlet in Perspective. And it provides a little bit of a broader perspective on Shakespeare than just being in love with his words. And here's what James says. "One of the things that makes Shakespeare a great man of the theater is that he knew the real thing when he saw it. He knew that power couldn't be wished out of the world. If power were used wisely and firmly, then everyone might thrive. If it were mismanaged, corruption ensued as surely as rats brought plague, and the whole state went rotten. Shakespeare believed in order and degree." Later on in the essay, James says, "The world could go on changing unimaginably, and Hamlet would still have everything to say to us. Hamlet poses the eternal question of whether life is worth living. The answer that he appears to arrive at is that it isn't, but the way he says so makes us realize that it is. Hamlet has been given the creative vitality of Shakespeare himself. Even though robbed of will, he's still the embodiment of individuality. Hamlet is what it means to be alive." So, now we're going to have a flashback in my life. And we're going to go back to my teenage years. Here's my first memory of Shakespeare and his capacity to be right on target. I am a high school student lying on the living room couch on a Saturday afternoon. My boyfriend has stood me up and he's going out with another girl. With my English textbook propped on my stomach, I have been working on an assignment, and that is memorizing Anthony's speech to the citizens of Rome in Act 3, Scene 2 of Julius Caesar. You know the one, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears." So Caesar has been assassinated. Brutus, an honest and honorable man, has been manipulated into joining the conspiracy to do it, and he believes that it will be for the welfare of Rome. And Brutus is going to give a funeral oration to pay Caesar his due respect. Anthony, whose speech I am memorizing, lying there on the couch, is a power-craving conniver who has convinced Brutus to let him speak to the people after Brutus speaks. He promises he will not castigate the conspirators. However, he gets up there and he works the crowd up to a pitch. "Oh, judgment, thou art fled to brutish beast, and men have lost their reason. Bear with me. My heart is in the coffin there with Caesar, and I must pause till it come back to me." So as I am memorizing this speech, I am listening to Dinah Washington on the stereo singing "Since I Fell for You." And this is the juxtaposition. Here's what came together in my self, in my head. And I won't do it the way she did it, but I think you know the song. You made me leave my happy home. And you took my love, now you're gone, since I fell for you. Love brings such misery and pain. I guess I'll never be the same since I fell for you. Later on, Anthony says to the people, I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator as Brutus is, but as you know me all, a plain, blunt man that love my friend. So Anthony has the people in his pocket and has, with his shenanigans, poisoned them against Brutus. As you know, there's a battle, and Anthony's on one side, Brutus is on the other, and it does not end well for Brutus. And so the noblest of all Romans ends up falling on his own sword, and that's the end. So what I learned from Shakespeare in those teenage years, and what has stayed with me over the years in that memory, is that treachery can come from someone who appears to be trustworthy. And some people can use underhanded means to manipulate other people. And love can bring misery and pain. As Dinah sings it, I guess I'll never see the light. I get the blues most every night since I fell for you. Not crystallized yet, but there is the gem. You made me turn against my noble Brutus. You took my heart, and now you're gone. That is the door that opened. That is the first gem I received from Shakespeare and the beginning of my understanding of the human heart. And now we're going to hear from Judy.
And that's why we love Shakespeare, because he was the world's greatest psychologist. He understood the passions, the human passions that we all go through, and to this day, haven't changed that much. William Shakespeare was born in a very difficult time. Half the population of England had the English population was going down because of the plague. People died of all kinds of fevers, lists of fevers, we don't even know what they were. Most people couldn't read and write. It was a short, nasty, and brutish existence. And yet he brought to us some of the greatest language and plays that have ever been written. Not too far from some of the things we experience today. But at any rate, I wanted to just talk about this book, which I picked up from the library, Shakespeare Basics for Grown-Ups. And it's wonderful. I want to read some phrases to you. You tell me if these are not things that every one of us says at least once, if not every day, during the week. A dish fit for the gods, that's from Julius Caesar. All of a sudden, that's from Taming of the Shrew. As luck would have it, The Merry Wives of Windsor. At one fell swoop, that's from Macbeth or the Scottish play. Brevity is the soul of wit, that's also Hamlet. Discretion is the better part of valor, from Henry IV, Part 1. The dogs of war, from Julius Caesar. Good riddance comes from Troilus and Cressida. Love is blind is in several of his plays. The Gentleman of Verona, Henry V, and Merchant of Venice. And the milk of human kindness is from Macbeth. And this is part of a speech by Lady Macbeth, when she castigates her husband for not being ruthless enough. Yet do I fear thy nature. It is too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way. And I think, boy. Anybody watch the Republican debate? And Wild Goose Chase, this comes from Romeo and Juliet. I mean, Shakespeare is just through our culture, through our language, in all kinds of things. I have to say, when Susan asked me, I was like, oh, yeah, Shakespeare, what? You know, I haven't read a Shakespearean play in a long time. But then when I started looking at some of these things, I saw how intertwined with humanity he really is. His themes are universal: fate, jealousy, revenge, order, disorder. And I'm just going to read from this particular book by E. Foley and B. Coates. If you're a fan of soap operas or even big blockbuster movies, you will have noticed that whether you're in Peyton Place or Los Angeles, certain plot elements are likely to reoccur. If someone gets hit on the head, they will end up with amnesia. If a teenager has sex, they will get pregnant. Brothers and sisters-in-laws are always getting it on. Whomever a character thinks is their father probably isn't. Weddings all end in fisticuffs, and so on and so on. Shakespeare is, of course, an artist of the highest order, but it is true that he had some favorite themes, motifs, and events that crop up again and again. I'm not going to belabor the point, but I do want to end by reading my favorite quote from Shakespeare, which sort of appeals to my rather jaundiced view of life and human nature. And Susan referred to it too, and this is from Macbeth. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury and signifying nothing. Thank you. It's also a very good book.
Oh, I was going to read that, and I didn't have
time. Thank you, Judy, for that. For that last quote, I remember when I took the teacher's exam in the city, we knew there was going to be something from Shakespeare on it, and I was studying with someone I wasn't studying with him. He read all of the Shakespeare plays in one day, thinking he could answer the question. And of course, the quote was, "Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased?" From Macbeth, but you wouldn't know that if you'd read every play in one day. We are now going to hear from Bibi, who's going to present her version of Shakespeare, her thoughts about Shakespeare.
Hello, I'm Bibi Pretnar. I'm 14, and I'm going to read a passage from Romeo and Juliet to start this off, where Friar Lawrence is trying to I'm going to read a passage from Romeo and Juliet where Friar Lawrence is trying to warn Romeo to love slowly, but Romeo disregards his warning and dies. These violent delights have violent ends, and in their triumph die, like fire and powder, which as they kiss consume. The sweetest honey is loathsome in his own deliciousness, and in the taste confounds the appetite. Therefore, love moderately, long love doth so. Too swift arrives, as tardy as too slow. Love stories and tragedies can come together in a very distinct way. They are meant to evoke emotions of sadness overwhelming happiness, joy, and even heartbreak. Romeo and Juliet is a well-known story that depicts love and tragedy. Their story is not unlike Cinderella's. What I mean by this is that they both fall in love at first sight, but the alikeness goes no further than that. Each of the pairs went about love in completely different ways. Romeo and Juliet loved each other so deeply that they would rather die for each other than have anyone else, while Cinderella and her prince shared their happiness and joy that came from their love with their whole kingdom. Although their love was toxic, I think we can learn from Romeo and Juliet's mistakes. What I mean is not every love will be your last. Not each experience is the best one, but it will not be the last one you have. And probably the best thing I learned from this play was love slowly and cautiously.
Romeo and Juliet, when I was talking with several people and asking them about Shakespeare, almost everyone said West Side Story, Romeo and Juliet. So that was, you know, that was their connection to Shakespeare. So I'm so glad we had Romeo and Juliet represented today. Next, we are going to hear from Emma, and we need to get her from the nursery. So Judy, would you... Okay. Yes, there is someone there. So, so far, I think we're doing the bard well. He might be pleased. On the other hand, he might not be. I'm so happy, though, to know from what Josh told us some time ago that we might still be breathing his air. We'll explain that some other time. All right, we're going to have Emma Strunk come and give us her version of Shakespeare. Ready? And then after Emma finishes, we'll have a little time for sharing.
Hi, everybody. This is a nice little treat. I'm normally in the nursery if you haven't seen me around, but I've been going here since I was probably 3. Took a little break for college, but now I'm back. Well, anyway, when I was in 8th grade, the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Company came to my school and performed the famous scene from Romeo and Juliet, where the two lovers meet. To try to relate to us, they dressed the actors in modern clothing and set the scene in a subway train. To this day, Romeo and Juliet is my favorite play of all time. And for those of you who don't know, I'm a sucker for mushy, gushy romances with depressing, tearjerker, horrific endings. But throughout most of my life, Shakespeare has been there on my shoulder, whether I realized it or not. I was raised knowing the question, to be or not to be, and playfully recited, "What light through yonder window breaks," even though I had no idea what either of them meant. Even the words that I use on a daily basis turned out to be created by him, like eyeball, rant, lower, and bedroom, to name a few. But being an actor, you are taught that Shakespeare is your God, and his plays are your Bible. And I had a really hard time understanding how a man who died hundreds of years ago could have possibly written plays that have any worth to contemporary audiences. All I needed was one good production, and I was converted. I have stayed up all night reciting his poetry over and over and found new meaning in it every single time. I have exhausted the repeat buttons on videos of actors performing scenes and monologues, and I still get chills when I think about it to this day. I have even lived and breathed as some of his characters and have found so much of myself in them that it was frightening. The summer of my college graduation, I had the absolute pleasure of apprenticing with Commonwealth Shakespeare Company in Boston. And in those 3 months, we studied Shakespeare, we understudied their production of Twelfth Night, and then we finished off our training with a production of our own called Much Ado About Nothing. If you ever get a chance to see this play, do it. Do not hesitate. You won't regret it. It is wildly accepted as Shakespeare's best comedy, and in my opinion, it also wins the award for the best couple. And I was honored to be cast as the leading lady, Beatrice, and quickly discovered that I was pretty much playing myself. So, if you don't know, Beatrice is stubborn and headstrong, but she's wickedly smart and witty and well-rounded. She is the exact opposite of a damsel in distress or a naive ingenue. And she starts off the play swearing off men, specifically her male rival, Benedick, who, of course, is perfect for her in every single way, and they're the only two who don't acknowledge it. But unlike so many Shakespeare plays, the two of them do not fall madly in love the moment their eyes meet, and they certainly aren't on the brink of suicide the moment they're separated. And they fight every moment of the play against their feelings, and even after they've finally admitted their love for one another, they continue to battle against displaying affection or releasing any bit of dominance in their relationship. And in their own strange little way, they are completely equal, very strong, and lovable characters. But outside of all the madness and mayhem of these two getting together, there is another plot that reveals a very dark and wonderfully depressing edge to this play that also brings out a striking dynamic to these very comedic characters. Beatrice's cousin, Hero, whom she loves and adores, is horrifically wronged at the altar of her wedding by her husband-to-be, Claudio, who thinks that Hero has been unfaithful. Chaos ensues, and even Hero's father disowns her, and it leaves Beatrice fuming for revenge. So what does Shakespeare give you? A love scene. A love scene so good that it rivals my love for Romeo and Juliet. So Benedick comes to confront Beatrice and comfort her, and out of nowhere, he finally comes out and admits his love by saying, "I do love nothing in the world so well as you. Is not that strange?" To which she replies, "As strange as the thing I know not, it were possible for me to say I love nothing so well as you, but believe me not. And yet I lie not. I confess nothing, nor I deny nothing. I am sorry for my cousin." So Benedict does some probing to finally get her to just admit it and says, "I protest, I love thee." So she says, "You have stayed me in a happy hour. I was about to protest I loved you." So he says, "And do it with all thy heart," to which she finally replies, "I love you with so much of my heart that none is left to protest." Excited to finally hear these words, Benedict says, "Come, bid me do anything for thee." And Beatrice delivers my favorite line in the entire play, "Kill Claudio." I wish I had my lovely man who played Benedict to really do that scene justice, but trust me, it's out of nowhere and it's brilliant. So only Beatrice and Benedict's love scene could take such a crazy twist, and it absolutely goes ballistic. And she ends up completely calling out his manhood and saying if she were a man, she would eat Claudio's heart in the marketplace. Like, what a great line for a strong woman role. Kind of eat your heart. But these scenes make Benedict and Beatrice so unbelievably human. They aren't just two people living happily ever after. They are constantly fighting to figure out what's right. And when faced with these horrible tragedies and confusion, they end up connecting in ways that they probably wouldn't have, that probably wouldn't have been possible. So you know they love each other because they're doing everything in their power to try to not love each other. And watching them fail is as beautiful and confusing as it is to experience it in your own life. And to find out how it all resolves, you're just gonna have to see the show, but trust me, it's worth it. And these ideas of heartbreak by someone you thought you trusted or loving someone despite all of your instincts saying no are feelings that many of us encounter at some point in our lives. In fact, the whole play is rich with these intense emotions we can all relate to regardless of the colorful language or the outdated clothing. And it was my job as an actor to take this character and present her in such a way that could make any type of person in the audience understand her and relate to her. And I had to find subtle ways to get her jokes to land without having to make people think too hard. And when Shakespeare is done right, the entire story is perfectly illustrated in front of you, and all you have to do is just let go and soak it all in. But when I let Beatrice sink into me, I found out that what she was really doing was just igniting pieces of me that were already there. My stubbornness had blindsided me just like her, and she helped me realize that I wasn't being true to myself and I needed to find my strength again. And swear off all men, so to speak. And of course, as the play would have it, in doing this, I discovered my own Benedick. But I also discovered my absolute love and devotion for my sister, who I'd lost touch with. I have seen so much Shakespeare in the 14 some odd years that I've been involved with theater, and I have yet to find a play or performance that doesn't connect with my life in some way, even if it's just to bring out some comedic relief when I otherwise have a very stressful time. There's a reason why celebrities flock to iconic Shakespearean roles and actors train their whole lives and bodies just to perform one Shakespeare show. And there's a reason why we keep modernizing his stories and reciting his poetry. Shakespeare managed to capture the essence of what it's like to be human and every type of feeling that comes with it. I will continue to grow and continue to soak in his work, and I will continue to learn that this above all, to thine own self be true.
Wow. Okay, well, now is the time in our service when we get to hear back from you. If you would like to share anything with us or if you have anything, questions, Lita, here you go.
Well, a couple of things that I connected with that speech of Anthony. At, you know, I had, I guess I read that play in school, and I remember just the first few lines. I didn't memorize the whole thing, but that never really left me because it's very, very dramatic, extremely, and at points very sarcastic as well. But, you know, Brutus is an honorable man, you know, that kind of thing. Now, also, I saw Hamlet several times, and I can still remember when he rejected Ophelia, he said, "Get thee to a nunnery," you know, the way he said it. And that was definitely, you know, how they felt about women. If they couldn't, you know, marry, that's what they had to do. They had to go to a nunnery. And that kind of made me mad, because at that time, that's how they looked at women. It was very typical. So I remembered that, and I said to my husband, I think maybe he deserved to be killed after that.
Okay, wait a minute. I think Bob has something, and then we'll go back to Mark.
Judy and I love to go to Cape May in the summer for a vacation. And one of the things we did for entertainment was that there was an improvisational group, the complete works of Shakespeare in 20 minutes. And it was interactional. So they picked Judy to be Ophelia's id. And what she had to do was say, "Ooh, ow, do it now. Ooh, ow." Since that time, that has become my motto.
So when I was back in high school 150 or so years ago, right over here in Lakeland, when I was in 11th or 12th grade, there was an English teacher named Keith McKenna, and he had electives. So you could pick an elective, an English elective, and he did Shakespeare. And he said, "We're going to break down the play scene by scene, line by line, monologue by monologue." And I'm like, okay, I'll take that, because I was, you know, a potential victim just wandering in the hallways looking for larger people to hit me. So I figured that would be a good place for me to go, because they probably won't be there. That class opened my eyes. It was amazing. We went through about three or four plays and broke each of them down. And just even the tense of the words that he would use, the narrative that he wove into it, when looked at in detail, just opened my eyes very wide. So I've been a fan of Shakespeare's for years. Two things. Well, now, you talk about West Side Story and its relation to being a modernized retelling of Romeo and Juliet. How many people here saw the TV show the past few years, Sons of Anarchy?
Yes.
The first season was Hamlet. Mm-hmm. So watching that, I know the plan, like, damn. Hamlet told with motorcycle gangs and leather jackets. That was perfect. That was perfect. The other thing is, if you go online, I'm not sure where it is, but you can get a mug, a coffee mug, that is covered in small type of Shakespearean insults. He was vile. He could tell you to go to hell in such a way that you'd look forward to the trip. And you're looking at, and you're like, it's perfect. And when I get that'll be a present for you. I think if I can find that again online, I will give that to you.
Some of those, maybe sometime. Anybody else want to have anything to share?
I studied Shakespeare with a bunch of different teachers through high school and through college, but I still remember my 10th grade English teacher, Jack McNeil, who had this wonderful way about him and was able to explain and demonstrate how one recites iambic pentameter. And it just puts the whole thing in a different light. When you get the timing and the cadence and you just kind of get it.
I had the pleasure of a previous life being an actor, and I performed in 6 different summer Shakespeare festivals. The Edinburgh Theatre Festival, the Champlain Shakespeare Festival, the Louisville Shakespeare Festival, the Villanova Shakespeare Festival, and Joseph Papp's Public Theater. And every single time, even when we repeated the plays, I mean, it was just always so enlightening. And just there was something about performing outside and having your entrance come from the dark into the lighted stage and performing in the round. And if anybody hasn't seen Shakespeare outside, do it.
My husband and I waited for 6 hours in line to go in to see Papp's production of Hamlet with James Earl Jones playing, Stacey Keach playing Hamlet and James Earl Jones playing Claudius. Did anybody else want to share anything?
Oh, it was fabulous. It was fantastic. It was worth 6 hours.
So a couple of things. When I was with my kids a number of years ago in London, we did go to the Reconstructed Globe Theater, which is also a museum, which is just fantastic if you ever get a chance, because it's set up just the way it was in his day with the pit, and you could stand there and watch the play, which is kind of amazing too. But for those who can't get to London, there is a terrific remake of Much Ado About Nothing by Joss Whedon. It's about 2 years old. It's filmed in his home, which is not a small house, and I recommend it.
Hi, my name is Gil, and first of all, I just want to say it was great to see BB and Emma up there.
Yeah,
really. Yeah. Sort of like, wow. Just so young and so good, but also just remembering teaching them and Emma singing up front. So that was nice. And I saw, I liked seeing Shakespeare outdoors. I saw Midsummer Night's Dream in Central Park, and I know a way of getting in without waiting. And it was William Hurt. And it was just an amazing production to see that in Central Park with a full moon. And then I saw Hamlet recently with Sam Waterston as Polonius, which was screechingly awful, but because I like him a lot from various movies and Law and Order, but that was awful, so sometimes it can get a little weird. But the one thing I just wanted to say about reading Shakespeare is I studied acting. I never got to be on stage, and our teacher wanted us to do Shakespeare, and we were like, no. And she said, it's in English. And that's all I really needed to hear. You know, Shakespeare's in English. It's maybe a little difficult to get through, and that opened a door for me to read all his plays. So I really recommend reading all his plays. So that's it. Thank you.
Audrey.
my mom took me and my sister and my brother Carson to see the play Hamlet with Benedict Cumberbatch in it. And it was so amazing. They did this, the director, I think, made it seem like it was timeless. So he would take items from different eras and put them in the play. But there was one thing that really captured my eye. It was, it's really sad. It's Ophelia's suicide scene. But they did it in such a beautiful way where she starts out playing the piano and she's sitting there and she's just playing one note. And then she gets up, but the piano's still going. And they made it sound so ethereal. And then after that, after the piano's playing, she walks up, I don't know, a hill of dust? I can't remember. And then there's just this light from the right side and it's shining on her and it's so beautiful. And she dies.
One of the saddest deaths in Shakespeare's Ophelia. So, so sad, and painted many, that scene painted many times and worked with many times.
I'm David. Thank you, Susan, and everybody who participated. I mean, there's so much. I'm sure most of us have had an experience or can tell a tale about Shakespeare. He didn't really take for me in earlier years. I think I needed to do a little bit of growing and experiencing of the world before. So I kind of been making up for lost time ever since. I'd have to say that reading and attending his plays has been a great delight. And you know, it's just kind of the way my mind works, I guess. You know, there are people who think that the guy from Stratford was not the guy or the only guy who wrote the plays. And I would have to probably count myself among those who has explored a little bit about, you know, the controversy. You know, by no means is it essential at all or even necessary to enjoy the plays and to get everything there is to get out of them. It's completely a sidebar. I certainly accept that. But I continue to be totally astonished at the breadth and depth in these plays and find it impossible to believe that guy could have done all of this. That's all. But there's one other thing. My wife and I met at Boscobel at Hudson Valley Shakespeare. And I don't remember which play it was, but I can definitely say it was not The Taming of the Shrew. And there's a wonderful line, if I can get it right, from The Merchant of Venice, because our relationship really got started around music. Our first serious date was actually at the Met Opera, in an opera set to a play by Friedrich Schiller, so that wasn't Shakespeare. But anyway, it's something about, and I'll paraphrase a more inclusive pronoun here, that the human without, you know, let no human be trusted who is without music. They are fit for treason, stratagems, and spoils.
Love that one. Also love, if music be the food of fools, play on.
I just want to see Susan go through the ceiling. Could I see that one more time, please? Yes. My question is, occasionally you hear the question come up about, was a woman involved? Was a woman really the writer? I never understood or have heard who that woman is supposed to have been. Do you know?
You know, I think it might be a reference to the Dark Lady. I don't know of any reference to a woman writing any of Shakespeare, but there is a reference to all kinds of conjectures about the sonnets that he wrote to the Dark Lady and who that might have been.
One reason that intrigues me, the idea of a woman being the writer so much, is that it seems to me that it would be a woman that would have that kind of sensitivity.
Well, I think this is why Shakespeare's this is genius. He was able to have the feelings of women at a time when women were not portrayed in the way that Emma described, the strong character, these strong women. And
the funny thing is they were boys playing these women's parts, but he still was into the head and the soul of women. And I don't think there was a woman writing, but he certainly had the perspective, the universal perspective of both the male and the female point of view. So I think at this point, oh, one more.
Hi, I'm Pam. Thank you, Susan. I'm glad to see the response that this has on the congregation, and thank you, everyone, for presenting. Thank you, Emma. As I had the pleasure of seeing Emma's performance, of course, and it was just transporting. I'm not biased or anything. One of the things that is wonderful now about theater is the accessibility of these performances. And the performance that Audrey was talking about is available in theaters, and you can go to a certain number of theaters. It costs more than a regular movie, but you're seeing their live streams, and they'll usually do encore performances like they did with Benedict, because we got to see one of those. Ooh, that's right. That was part of the crossover of different eras. That was part of that amazing, you know, what it seems to excite in creative people, such inspiration like that, the Hamlet production, the set design, the concepts, that Benedict's performance. How can you perform these lines that everyone has heard ad nauseum and suddenly make them sound like he just came up with them, that they were just as fresh as that? So definitely, if you ever have an opportunity, it's either National Theater or Globe Theater. I know it plays at Jacob Burns. It plays in White Plains and Danbury. Unfortunately, you can't usually find out about it unless you look for it. It's not really advertised in a big way, but it's a wonderful experience if you can't hop on a plane and go over and actually see these things live.
There's just one thing that I want to say. Carol, I do want to respond to you, too. Regarding women, I don't know if anyone has seen the Helen Mirren production of The Tempest. It's on video. It is the most fabulous thing. Julie Taynor, it's an incredible production. And Helen Mirren is an incredible Prospero, who does it absolutely as finely as any man who ever performed it. So really see that if you can see it. And Carol, here you go. We'll have your last comment.
It's funny, I was thinking the same thing about how nice it was that Shakespeare has become so accessible. Between having Bosco Bell right nearby and these live stream performances in the theater. I just wanted to say also for everybody's information that As You Like It is going to be in Jacob Burns next month. So if you are interested in that, it's, I think, the 25th of February. And it's 2 in the afternoon, right? Just if you're not doing anything else. Also, did anybody see the Macbeth with Alan Cumming a couple of years ago on Broadway, where he played every role? No, it wasn't bloody. It took place in a hospital, a mental hospital, where Macbeth had sort of lost it, you know, out of his guilt and everything. But Macbeth, Alan Cumming played every role. It was the most incredible thing I ever saw.
I get a chance to see that sometime. Well, at this point, we're going to move on to our next part of the service, and that is to have a brief tribute at this point to Martin Luther King, whose weekend this is. I've been trying to think of all of the characters in Shakespeare that Martin Luther King might remind me of. I did find an article about the movie Selma, in which the reviewer speaks of Selma as being a kind of a Shakespearean production in which there are characters who give soliloquies. I think perhaps Hamlet. He knew, Martin Luther King knew, something was rotten, horribly rotten in our country, and he was tasked, he felt tasked to do it. So that's kind of the connection I might make if we were thinking. Certainly kingly, certainly someone who did an incredible work and gave an incredible heroic amount to this country. So I wonder if this point, if we could just have a moment of silence for this man who gave his life to make this country better, and just a moment of silence to think of him. We are grateful, grateful, grateful that there was a Martin Luther King in our world, and may we remember him every year at this time. We have a closing hymn now that very much relates to the time in which all of this was going on. We Shall Overcome, and it's number 169 in the book. So thank you all. Thanks so much to those who were part of sharing their thoughts and their feelings about a great writer who's helped to give us a roadmap for living and for this tribute to a great hero who gave his life for us. And now we have our benediction song, which we sing together, and as the words are in the program, and Pam will lead us in that song. May the longtime sun shine upon you. May the Lord go in peace.